This is your State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer-Kent, and our first guest this morning is the Wisconsin Attorney General, who is now in the last year of his first term. Josh Call joins us, and what questions do you have about his work this morning? Join us at 1-800-642-1234 or email us ideas@WPR.org. Attorney General Call, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Lee. Thanks for having me on the program.
I just heard you in the news there, so let's follow up a little bit with the tribal right to spearfish. Last week, as the Melissa reminded us, you reminded Wisconsinites of the protected tribal right to fish in ceded territories and the legal consequences people could face if interfering with the Ojibwe spring spearing and netting season. Just tell us why it's necessary to remind residents of this tribal right and the penalties for folks for interfering.
Well, first, it's important for folks to know that this is a contractual right that goes back decades to when certain territories in Wisconsin were ceded. And it's vital that people know that there are specific rights provided for in those agreements to hunt and fish and gather. And there are criminal penalties if people interfere with the exercise of those rights. We want to get the message out so that people across the state know that this will be happening soon, and that it's vital that people respect those rights, both because historically that is an agreement that was made, but also because both the DNR and law enforcement are committed to enforcing the laws if there are violations.
Attorney General Call, last month, your Department of Justice filed a lawsuit that says Tyco Fire Products and Johnson Controls Incorporated released PFAS chemicals or forever chemicals into the environment in Marinette. Tell us about the lawsuit.
One of the biggest sources of PFAS contamination in Wisconsin is in the Marinette area. This is an issue that has been impacting communities around the state, though. And it's an issue that we have been looking into as well as the Department of Natural Resources. What we have alleged in the complaint that we filed recently is that Tyco and Johnson Controls are responsible for PFAS contamination, primarily resulting from the testing of firefighting foams at a fire technology center, again, in the Marinette area. That has caused severe contamination of the waters there. A number of people have had to drink bottled water because their wells have tested too high in PFAS. We have had some progress made as there have been efforts to remediate the contamination, but it hasn't gone as far as we would like. And so we have brought this court action seeking a court order mandating that there be a permanent solution to the contamination and also requesting forfeitures to deter this kind of pollution from happening in the future.
Attorney General Call, what would be the best possible outcome here of this lawsuit? What do you hope the resolution could be?
There are a few things that we're looking for, and I have to say part of my thinking on this was informed by a listening session that I had in Marinette. I went and heard from residents of the community about the impacts that PFAS contamination is having on them and their lives. One thing that's critical is that we get an order requiring that Johnson Controls and Tyco engage in all of the testing that they need to engage in to make sure that they have remediated all the PFAS in the area and that they're going to make sure that permanent clean water solution is in place. And then secondly, having forfeitures both hopefully can help us work to remediate some of the harm in that area, but also send a message that if there is PFAS contamination, companies need to act swiftly to clean it up. And more importantly, they need to make sure that they're preventing the kind of contamination that we've seen in the Marinette area from happening.
Attorney General Josh Call, our guest, Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call, our guest, and Attorney General Call, do you expect more lawsuits like this one? As mentioned, there are PFAS contamination areas around the state. So does the Justice Department go further?
It's certainly possible. We worked with Governor Evers last year to request authority to bring in outside counsel to evaluate potential PFAS claims in Wisconsin. That process is still ongoing, and that's in addition to this action we filed against Johnson Controls and Tyco. But we are continuing to evaluate that issue, and where there is PFAS contamination and we can work to protect clean water in Wisconsin, We're going to look very hard at what our legal options are so that we can ensure that every Wisconsinite has access to clean water, and that they don't, we're taking action to hold accountable those who are responsible.
Attorney General Josh Call, taking your questions as well this morning at 1-800-642-1234. And Attorney General Call, I'd ask you about the Assembly's legislative branch has a special counsel, which is led by the former Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman from the judicial, formerly of the judicial branch. The Justice Department is part of the executive branch, but it's all about checks and balances here. So I'd be interested in knowing, with the special counsel's investigation from the legislature into the 2020 election, how the Attorney General sees it and what role, if any, the Justice Department has in overseeing it.
Well, first, this investigation never should have been started, and it needs to come to an end as quickly as possible. Back in October of last year, I called for Speaker Voss to shut this investigation down. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. And since that time, we haven't really learned anything new about what's happened in Wisconsin elections, but we have wasted a lot of taxpayer dollars. Now, Justice Gableman issued a number of subpoenas. Our office has been involved in representing some of the people who've been subpoenaed, and we're challenging those. Our basic argument is that if people are going to testify to a legislative committee, that should happen in public, in a public hearing, where Wisconsinites can hear directly from the folks who administer elections. But Justice Gableman is fighting in court to try to have those interviews, depositions conducted in private. But more broadly, it's clear at this point that Justice Gableman is just engaging in conspiracy theories here. He suggested that our elections could be decertified, which his own attorney has said is incorrect. And he also put out some factual claims that have now been debunked, claims about voting at nursing homes. And in any legitimate investigation, if there were false claims made, you would immediately see an effort to correct those claims, some sort of explanation for how it happened. But here they've just been left to linger by Justice Gableman and his team. It's one of numerous signs that this is not a serious investigation. So this needs to come to an end.
And the spring elections across Wisconsin take place tomorrow. What role does the Justice Department have in overseeing or making sure that these happen without any trouble or concern?
Well, what's important for Wisconsinites to know is that if there is any information that they have indicating that there is voter fraud or voter intimidation at the polls, that they should report that information to local law enforcement. We work with local law enforcement to provide and DAs to provide information about election integrity. And the good news is that in Wisconsin, we have safe and secure elections. But if there is any malfeasance in the process, we want people to report that so that appropriate enforcement action can be taken to protect people's right to vote.
And at the same time, Wisconsin's state legislative redistricting district still up in the air as a result of a U.S. Supreme Court overturning a state Supreme Court decision that was won on behalf of Governor Evers, that you won on behalf of Governor Evers. What happens next in the redistricting for Wisconsin?
That remains to be seen. You know, we, as you said, I'm some of my colleagues and I are representing Governor Evers in the redistricting litigation. You know, it had been our hope at the beginning of this process that we would see truly fair maps at the end of this. Early on in the process, though, the state Supreme Court put out a standard that said that they would adopt the map that had the least changes from our current heavily gerrymandered maps. Fortunately, the maps the state Supreme Court initially adopted were fairer maps. They're still not totally fair. But unfortunately, the U.S. Supreme Court has said that the state Supreme Court has to go back to the drawing board on those. So what's going to happen next is that we're going to hear from the state Supreme Court about what, if any, additional steps it wants to see before that court ultimately determines what map to put in place. I expect that that's going to move pretty quickly and that we'll see something in the next few weeks because deadlines for taking out nomination papers are coming up soon. And so this process will need to move quickly.
Attorney General of the state of Wisconsin, Josh Call, our guest this morning. We're having a little trouble with the phone, so if you'd like to get a question in, it should be via email, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. We'll get that phone fixed for us straight away. But in the meantime, if you have a question for the Attorney General of Wisconsin, you can get it in ideas@WPR.org this morning. Our conversation continues. I'm Lee Rayburn, and this is your State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call is our guest. It's your State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we welcome your questions for Attorney General Call this morning. Our phones are back in order, so you can line them up at 1-800-642-1234. And Attorney General Call, I want to ask you about Wisconsin's share of the opioid settlement money. I believe we stand to receive about $400 million from a lawsuit settlement with drug makers related to the opioid crisis. Where should this money go?
Well, first, you're right. It's going to be about $400 million. That's going to be coming from three opioid distributors, as well as an opioid manufacturer. It's part of a nationwide settlement. And under state law, a law that was passed last year, 70% of those dollars will go to counties and cities in Wisconsin. And the other 30% will be going to the Department of Health Services. I know that the Department of Health Services is working on a plan for how those funds get allocated. There will be about $50 million coming to both the state and county and local governments this year alone. But I think it's critical that the investments be made in doing everything we can to fight the opioid epidemic. Now, fortunately, the settlement provides that the funds need to go to opioid abatement. But that's going to include and I think should include things like funding for treatment programs, funding for recovery programs, funding to continue increasing public awareness about the danger of opioids to hopefully prevent people from becoming addicted, and then funding for enforcement efforts to work to slow the tide of drugs coming into the state of Wisconsin.
Let's go to the phones and your questions for Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call at 1-800-642-1234, where John in Eau Claire is standing by. Good morning, John.
Good morning. I have a question for the Attorney General. I have never heard him utter a single criticism of the Biden's open border policy, which allows Chinese fentanyl to come across the border, which finds its way into Wisconsin and is killing our young people. If he spent half the time on that subject that he has on Gableman, I would be much happier.
The question would be about fentanyl, I suppose, and where it's coming from and what the state is doing in our Justice Department to address fentanyl on the streets, Attorney General Call?
Yeah, well, the first thing to make sure that people are clear about is how dangerous fentanyl is. Fentanyl is far more potent than even heroin, and it is a driver in the spike we have seen in opioid-related overdose deaths in Wisconsin. I think there are some several different things we need to be doing to make sure that we are fighting this danger. One is I think it's critical that we work to ensure that the large-scale drug traffickers who are distributing fentanyl are held accountable, and that we work to dismantle those drug trafficking networks. Now, fentanyl does come into the United States from outside of the country. It comes in a number of different ways, though. It comes in on land, by water, and through the mails. And working to dismantle those drug trafficking networks, I think, is the most important step. And that requires long-term, intensive investigations into these drug trafficking organizations. I was just going to say we also need to make sure that people are aware of how dangerous fentanyl is, and that it is often mixed with other drugs, and that people sometimes, in many cases, overdose not realizing that they're taking fentanyl. It's part of the reason it's all the more important to get folks into treatment and recovery programs, and it's part of the reason that using the $400 million we're going to be recovering to invest in treatment programs and recovery programs is vital.
Your office recently created two new assistant attorney general positions, I believe, to help the Appleton and Wausau field offices and local authorities there address some drug-related crimes. What's happening there that made this necessary?
Yeah, those positions actually go back to my predecessor's administration. We've kept them in place. They're regional drug prosecutors. And what they are is assistant AGs who work with DA's offices and law enforcement across the state to work on some of the most serious drug trafficking cases that we see in Wisconsin. That's important for a couple of reasons. One is they bring expertise in certain types of cases, including what are known as Len bias homicide cases, cases where people illegally sell drugs and then that results in a fatal overdose. In those cases, they often recently have involved fentanyl, and there are heightened penalties in place for the drug dealers who sell drugs that result in a fatal overdose. They also work when information is gathered, say in a local drug trafficking investigation. They work to bring those up to the next level in the supply chain and work their way up the distribution chain so that the most serious offenders, the higher level drug traffickers, can be held accountable. Now, the funding for those positions is going to run out next year. And so we are asking the legislature to continue providing funding for those positions. It's vital that we get that so we can continue to provide this resource to prosecutors around the state. And there's bipartisan support among prosecutors for this program.
Let's go back to your questions for our guest, Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call, this morning at 1-800-642-1234, where Mike in New London standing by. Mike, you're on the air.
Good morning. I appreciate being able to ask Josh a question. Given that the legislature will not meet and hold a hearing to approve Tony's appointees to the DNR board, what can be done? What are you doing to get Fred Prehn off the board?
Attorney General Call?
Yeah, so first, just the background to make sure your listeners are aware. There are appointees to the Natural Resources Board, which oversees the DNR. And right now, there is a 4-3 majority of appointees from Governor Walker, even though we're now in the fourth year of Governor Evers' term. And part of the reason for that is that one of Governor Walker's appointees has refused to leave the board. Now, you know, normally you might think, well, he can't refuse to leave. Of course, he needs to leave. Governor Evers was duly elected and gets to appoint the replacement. But what's happened is that Governor Evers' replacement has not been confirmed by the state Senate. And we've actually seen this on a number of other appointees as well. We brought a legal action seeking to remove Fred Prehn from the Natural Resources Board. That case is in front of the state Supreme Court. Arguments were held there pretty recently, and we're now awaiting a decision. So it's my hope that the Supreme Court will conclude that Fred Prehn needs to be removed and that Governor Evers can choose the person to fill that role. But right now that's going to be, that's awaiting a decision from the state Supreme Court. But this is also a really anti-democratic step that we're seeing from Fred Prehn, because essentially he's trying to override the will of the voters who elected Governor Evers to, among other things, select appointees for these critical executive branch roles. So it's my hope that he'll do the right thing and step aside, but so far that hasn't happened.
We got time for one more question quickly here. Martha in Menominee, you're on the air with Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Call. Mr. Voss and Mr. Gableman have spent almost $1 million trying to negate my vote. Could a private citizen or group bring a lawsuit against them for fraudulent business practices for selling my tax dollar for a work product that suggests illegal acts be done?
Martha, thank you. Attorney General Call, we've got about a minute.
Well, thank you for the question, Martha. I can't provide you any legal guidance on private actions, but unfortunately, one of the parts of the lame duck law that was passed in 2018 after Governor Evers and I were elected and Governor Walker and the Republicans in the legislature tried to undermine our authority was a provision that gave the legislature the ability to spend what they wanted to on attorneys. And we are now seeing this huge waste of taxpayer dollars on this Gableman investigation and on lawyers for Michael Gableman on top of the investigation. What I think is critical is that Wisconsinites continue speaking out and make clear to the legislative leaders that we have that that this is unacceptable and that we got to stop wasting our tax dollars through this investigation that is really an attack on our core democratic principles.
Attorney General Call, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me, Lee.
Josh Call is the Attorney General of Wisconsin. Up next news, then the State Capitol Report continues with Melinda Brennan, the new Executive Director of the Wisconsin Chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. Does that First Amendment cover our right to read, to learn, to discuss the news of the day in the classroom? You're listening to the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and for Kate Archer Kenton, what happens after we ban the books and make academic theories illegal? We're asking the ACLU of Wisconsin and you this morning at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Our guest, Melinda Brennan, took over as executive director of the ACLU of Wisconsin in January. Born and raised in Port Washington, Melinda earned her bachelor's and master's degree at UW-Milwaukee. Melinda, good morning and welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Let's begin with how you see your priorities for the ACLU in Wisconsin going forward.
Well, we have a lot of priorities and a very large platform, but really, if you're going to ask me what the priorities are, it's being in service to the communities of Wisconsin. And in particular, you just mentioned censorship and not being able to have meaningful conversations and dialogues across difference. And I think that's got to be one of the top priorities, maintaining our freedom of speech.
So can you see the other side of that argument, though, of why people would look towards infringing that speech or why they would look to protect from that speech?
Well, I would phrase it this way. If we're unable to have conversations about things that are incredibly important to us, then there's no way for us to come together on other issues. If we can't be informed via facts or any number of other conversations that are ongoing in our culture, I'm not sure how we're preparing children or the adults for more conversations and political debate. I think to restrict and to utilize censorship as a weapon of governmental overreach only infringes on everyone's rights. And so, unfortunately, I can't see the other side of the argument because I'd rather preserve the right for everyone.
So what does that do in regards to hate speech then? Where does that put hate speech in the context of our rights to free speech?
Well, I'll put it to you this way. Nobody's free speech should supersede or interfere with another person's pursuit of their own rights, liberties, or dignity. And hate speech is not actually covered. It's a violation of the freedom of expression because it's meant to be able to hurt and incite violence. And so freedom of speech is wide-ranging, and it's something that we should all avail ourselves of. But the moment when it becomes meant to rob someone of their dignity or to cause harm to that person, well, then that's no longer covered. And so I think not only K-12, but on college campuses, we need to be very careful about how we're thinking about how we maintain our communities, how we have robust dialogue, how people are able best to explore all kinds of topics, and to do so with respect to each other, because we are actually able to accomplish that if we try.
Wasn't there just a UW-Milwaukee panel discussion on this?
There was. The VP of our board, Angela Lang, who's also the executive director of Block, was asked to do a keynote at UWM. There's a series called, I believe, Difficult Conversations or Difficult Dialogues. There's a panel formed of students from across a number of different backgrounds, sometimes with competing ideas. And I think that the whole point of that series is actually excellent, because what it does is it models behavior for everyone in the audience, whether they're students, community members, people from campus, and they get to discuss openly and without reservation their ideas on an issue without the fear of people taking attacks at each other on the panel or from the audience. And they get to have a robust dialogue that hopefully leads to some greater understanding or more thoughtful, promised conversation of the future. And one of the things that was a takeaway for me from that conversation was there's the kind of work that I'm doing now, which at the ACLU, we're talking about the freedom of speech and we're talking about where that line ends in relation to hate speech. But there are also practical considerations on a college campus, for example. And just because you might have the freedom of speech to say terrible things that are not necessarily violent, that they don't trip over into the hate speech component, it doesn't mean that we as community members don't owe it to each other to do our very best to keep everybody involved in the conversation and to do so with dignity.
Melinda Brennan, our guest, she's the executive director of the ACLU of Wisconsin. What do you know about the mission of the ACLU? Has the organization defended positions which you agree or don't agree with? 1-800-642-1234 to join us or email ideas at WPR.org. Where does the term cancel culture fit in with all this as you see it, Melinda Brennan? As comedian Louis C.K. performed in my backyard in Madison earlier this year, received a Grammy last night, and yet he was one that we were told would be canceled as part of this cancel culture. Does that term mean anything to you in the ACLU?
Well, let me first answer just as me without my ACLU hat on. Okay. I am not personally a fan of cancel culture. And the reason is I'd rather have conversation. I would rather be able to hold people accountable, but still remain engaged in conversation. And for me, cancel culture literally means one side becomes so loud that the other can't speak at all. And I'm not sure that other than in very limited applications, that's helpful. Let me give you an example. If, for example, we're talking about cancel culture by trying to hold a company or a very large organization accountable by saying over and over again, we'd like you to address X and we don't believe you have adequately. That's one thing, but that's calling someone to account. That's not necessarily cancel culture because you're hoping that they'll respond.
It's consequences. What I don't,
right. Consequences and accountability. I'm all for those kinds of things. But if it's about foreclosing conversation and dialogue, there are a few circumstances under which I think that is incredibly helpful, but they're few. Otherwise, I would much rather pull someone to the side if it's an individual and say, hey, you know, you said something, and I'm going to speak from my own personal perspective here and say it made me really uncomfortable for these reasons, and I'd like you to just go forward thinking about that. I would much rather preserve relationships, bring as many community members to the table on an issue as I possibly can, because I think that benefits us all. So that's my my personal, as a longtime educator, take on cancel culture, that it has limited a limited ability to achieve its objectives. In terms of the ACLU, I don't think the ACLU has a particular view on cancel culture. I think the answer really has to be it's a matter of freedom of speech. So people should be free to express their speech from government intervention or overreach. And so that doesn't really weigh in on how we should be treating each other so we continue to engage in dialogue.
Melinda Brennan, our guest, executive director of the ACLU of Wisconsin. Your questions at 1-800-642-1234. The ACLU also works with undocumented folks here in Wisconsin, undocumented workers and victims of discrimination. That sort of advocacy is not easy, Melinda. So how does the ACLU decide when to take up these cases?
Well, I'll take a moment and say that we have a fantastic legal department, and some of their work that you're pointing towards is incredibly sensitive. We've got more requests than we could ever hope to answer to because of, well, real human limitations. There's only so many people on the team and so many hours in the day. So we very carefully vet the cases that come to us. Sometimes people come to us and sometimes we go to them. And we try to imagine what is the likely outcome. Can we do the most good for the most people by taking on a case? And that's why it's called impact litigation. If only I had an endless budget, I think we'd do an even more good job of taking on as many cases as possible. But there are some cases that are incredibly sensitive, particularly cases that have been informed by violence. As you suggest, whether it's governmental violence or whether it's interpersonal violence. And I would add to that as well, you didn't put it in your list, but folks that have been violated in their engagement with the carceral system. And so we think very carefully about how we can take on a case, do right by the person who came to us, who gave us the case, as well as what's the largest impact we can hope to get from this case. And so we do the work as ethically as we possibly can with vigorous debate, not only in-house, but with our partners at ACLU National, as well as any number of coalition partners in our community.
So Wisconsin's not among 30 states with laws protecting pregnant workers who require health-related accommodations. I'm wondering if the ACLU of Wisconsin is playing any role in dealing with this issue.
Well, this is what I'll say to you. I'm not going to comment on individual cases that may or may not be ongoing, but this is what I'll say. I have been a person who has been fighting for other people for a very long time. And whether that means advocating for them or uplifting their voices, opening doors, or having vigorous debate, people who are being treated badly because of one element or factor in their life, who may be marginalized, who are being actively discriminated against, that's the ACLU wheelhouse, as well as my own personal lifelong commitment. So if there are folks that are being treated very badly because of an element in their life, for example, pregnancy being weaponized against them, I think that they should have a right to have great representation and have their voices heard in the public sphere.
Melinda Brennan took over the role as executive director of the ACLU of Wisconsin at the beginning of the year. You've already taken your hat off once. And I'm wondering, are there times where you understand the bigger picture of the ACLU and its work that it's doing, but you could disagree with certain items or things?
Oh, certainly. And I think any number of us, I think a lot of folks who are in whatever you'd like to call them, whether they're social justice organizations or community-centered organizations, I think all of us understand that we might have a moment of pause when we're debating how we best handle an issue and whether or not we can take on a case, what our lane is. I think if we're going to be honest, all of us have those moments where we're trying to figure out what's best given our role. And so there can be moments where I take my hat off and I scratch my head and I say, well, if I was but a single person, but I'm not, because I'm representing as many of the platform interests as I can at any one time. And so, yes, I am a full human as well. But on the other hand, I am representing the ACLU of Wisconsin, our platform, our communities, and folks that need us. And I always have to pivot in that direction at the end of the day.
Melinda Brennan, our guest, executive director of the ACLU of Wisconsin, and taking your questions this morning at 1-800-642-1234. Have you been involved in a free speech or a civil rights case taken up by the ACLU? What was your experience? Are you or is someone you know an undocumented worker who sought representation from the ACLU attorneys? Join us, ideas at WPR.org or 1-800-642-1234. And our conversation with Melinda Brennan continues. I'm Lee Rayburn, and this is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. It's your State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and our guest is the new leader of the ACLU of Wisconsin. And while we have this time together, what would you like to know about your civil liberties and what the ACLU in our state would do to protect them? 1-800-642-1234 to join us, or email ideas at WPR.org. Melinda Brennan, the executive director of the ACLU of Wisconsin, stays with us. And Melinda, elections across the state will be held tomorrow. Republicans and Democrats battling in court over rules around the use of ballot drop boxes, absentee ballots. What do you want voters to know before they go to the polls tomorrow?
I want them to be able to vote. I want them to feel free from governmental intervention to stop them from voting. I want them to not be confused by having drop boxes, ballot boxes taken away from them during an election cycle. I think that was an incredibly unethical maneuver to disturb the cycle of an election so that people were more likely to be confused and less likely to vote. And so if I'm asking something of folks, I would ask them to make sure that they exercise their right to vote because everyone should have that right uninfringed.
Yeah. And are voting rights a concern for the ACLU? And if so, how does it fit in the bigger picture?
Well, right now, if I'm talking about Wisconsin particularly and battleground states in general, I would say that one of my greatest concerns is voting rights. Voting rights impact every other issue that's part of the dedicated platform of the ACLU nationally, as well as in the state of Wisconsin. I want people to be well-educated voters who know who their candidates are, feel free to ask them questions, are held accountable in public, but most importantly, that the rules are not changed mid-game so that people know how to exercise those rights to vote.
Melinda, much of your academic work, as I understand it, was sociology, women's and gender studies. You wrote your doctoral dissertation on white supremacy and Islamophobia. Wow. Just give us some idea about your background and how that paints your view as you step into your role as the executive director of the ACLU of Wisconsin.
Well, I'll say something that's often repeated in women's and gender studies classrooms as well as ethnic studies classrooms, and that's that your personal history greatly informs your worldview, and that your worldview is already political. And so for me, I come from and back home to a number of different kinds of communities, some of which are marginalized. And so part of my, I guess, advocacy all the way up until this moment has been thinking about what my role is in relation to a particular issue or community. And sometimes that means that I'm the one that opens the door and stands at the mic because I'm an impacted person. And sometimes that means, especially in this role, I get to open the door, grab the microphone, and pass it to someone who's less likely to be heard.
And Melinda, as you mentioned, not an attorney, and yet a lot of the work that the ACLU of Wisconsin does has a legal component. Is it common for a leader of a state chapter to not be an attorney? And so how do you work with the attorneys on your team?
Well, I'll say this. There are a lot of different pathways to becoming executive director of an ACLU affiliate. One of them is as coming up as an attorney and becoming the legal director and then eventually taking over the executive director seat. There are a number of other pathways, and I'll say this, I'm not a person who likes to brag, but I'm very well read, but better than that is I'm always a student, and so I have a lot to learn in all kinds of areas, and I appreciate the knowledge of subject matter experts, and so I'm a constant learner, but being in this chair means that I have to listen to all the best information, and at the very end of the day, call the play, and sometimes that means consulting with lots and lots of people. And sometimes it's one excellent argument, and it's very clear that that's the most ethical thing to do.
And talking about how your background paints your worldview from your academic standpoint, but what about your background in Wisconsin? You're growing up in Port Washington, going to school at UW-Milwaukee. How does that paint the way you see your role leading the ACLU of Wisconsin, Melinda?
Well, sure. Well, I'll say this. My family is originally, we're from a lot of places, but my family long-term has been from the south side of Milwaukee historically. I am the first person in my family to attend and graduate from college on one side. I am the first person certainly to get a master's in my family, a doctorate. My grandma, I think, had maybe a fourth or fifth grade education. We're not quite sure. And worked in factories her entire life and asked of her two daughters, please become educated because education was everything. And of course that was passed down to me and I took that very seriously. And I would say that my own personal experience squares with that because I was able to have conversations about who I was and see representation of myself, sometimes for the very first time in higher education. And so I think it's incredibly powerful to be able to have access to unrestricted conversations and voices that are less likely to be heard. And I think that should happen a lot earlier in the lives of students.
Melinda Brennan, our guest, executive director of the ACLU of Wisconsin, answering your questions about the role and direction of the ACLU of Wisconsin going forward at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Do you still hold true to that axiom, Melinda, that education is everything?
Yes. I absolutely do. But I would broaden the idea of education. I would say that it's not just formalized education, because formalized education always will pivot towards power. It's a system and it's created by the government. And so that means that disproportionately the voices within education are going to be somewhat more privileged than others. And so I would say that experiential education is incredibly important. Personal knowledge is incredibly important. And we should be able to put all kinds of different knowledge together and on the table to figure out what's best given a community dialogue.
So that sort of brings us full circle, Melinda, when you talk about the power, the systems behind education and the need to get education other, not just in the classroom, but in life and in the streets. So some parents and legislators in Wisconsin are seeking to limit how race and sexuality are taught in public schools. Where does the ACLU stand on removing books from school curriculum or banning teaching subjects such as critical race theory?
Absolutely unacceptable and literally governmental overreach. How are students supposed to become better informed if they can't have conversations about race? Explain to me how students who are young students of color never see representation. How will that benefit them? To say that race, or to frame that race and gender and sexuality are divisive concepts, is literally oppressive and censorship, which does nothing to handle the kinds of conversations that we need to have going forward and reforms. So by labeling the thing itself that we should be discussing as divisive, it's an end run around governmental overreach. And quite frankly, it's a dishonest framing of the entire conversation. We should have more access, greater access to more difficult conversations. And we shouldn't target various communities, communities of color, LGBTQ plus students. We shouldn't be targeting them with a silencing, a chilling effect, saying, well, we don't want to talk about you. Your life isn't valuable to us. It shouldn't be part of formalized education. That is just unacceptable to the ACLU, as well as I think a lot of parents who want robust conversation and education for their students and to see them represented and to feel pride in the education system.
Let's go to your calls at 1-800-642-1234, where Tom and Glenn Flora are standing by. Tom, you're on the air with Melinda Brennan, the executive director of the ACLU of Wisconsin.
Good morning. I have a question. Does the ACLU ever get involved in defending constitutional rights that are beyond civil liberties as we traditionally think, such as speech and religion and so on? Does the ACLU ever get involved in constitutional issues beyond civil rights?
Melinda?
Absolutely. First up on my mind is thinking about privacy and surveillance. For example, what tools can the police utilize in order to surveil, but to do so within the rights that we all have? That's one conversation. That's a national conversation that is not immediately tracked to marginalized people. But I would say that the way that surveillance often gets utilized is a nexus between civil rights and civil liberties, because we know that folks of color, particularly Black folks, are often surveilled far more than others.
Hey, Melinda Brennan, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
My pleasure.
Melinda Brennan is the executive director of the ACLU of Wisconsin, taking over that role in January. Just ahead, what happens when climate change renders neighborhoods and whole communities unlivable? We talked to Wisconsin officials who know because they've helped relocate their residents. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Kate Archer-Kent today, and you've been listening to the State Capitol Report this week, every Monday morning starting at 7 here on The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.